Jordan's insulting remarks to Mrs. Lish. Naturally, he was grateful for the Lish's support of the Capital Fund Drive, too. Naturally, Randy White assured Mrs. Lish, he would do something about the indignity she had suffered. When Owen and I were summoned to the headmaster's office, we did not know everything that Mitzi Lish had said about the incident. That was how Randy White referred to it. "I intend to get to the bottom of this disgraceful incident," the headmaster told Owen and me. "Did you or did you not proposition Mrs. Lish in the editorial offices of The Grave?" Randy White asked Owen.
"It was a joke," said Owen Meany. "She was laughing at me at the time. She made it clear that she thought I was a joke," he said. "And so I said something that I thought was appropriate."
"How could you ever think it was appropriate to proposition a fellow student's mother?" Randy White asked him. "On school property," the headmaster added.
Owen and I found out later that the business about the proposition occurring on school property had especially incensed Mrs. Lish. She'd told the headmaster that this was surely grounds for dismissal. It was Larry Lish who told us that. He didn't like us, but Larry was a trifle ashamed that his mother was so intent on having Owen Meany thrown out of school.
"How could you think it appropriate to proposition a fellow student's mother?" Randy White repeated to Owen.
"I meant that my remarks were appropriate to her behavior," Owen said.
"She was rude to him," I pointed out to the headmaster.
"She made fun of me being the class valedictorian," said Owen Meany.
"She laughed out loud at Owen," I said to Randy White. "She laughed in his face. She bullied him," I added.
"She was sexy with me," Owen said.
At the time, neither Owen nor I were capable of putting into words the correct description of the kind of sexual bully Mrs. Lish was. Maybe even Randy White would have understood our animosity toward a woman who lorded her sexual sophistication over us so cruelly, over Owen in particular. She had flirted with him. She had taunted him. She had humiliated him. Or she had tried to. What right did she have to be insulted by his rudeness to her in return? But I couldn't articulate this when I was 19 and fidgeting in the headmaster's office.
"You asked another student's mother if she would sleep with you in the presence of her own son," said Randy White.
"You don't understand the context," said Owen Meany.
"Tell me the context," said Randy White.
Owen looked stricken.
"Mrs. Lish revealed to us some particularly damning and unpleasant gossip," Owen said. "She seemed pleased at how the nature of the gossip upset me."
"That's true, sir," I said.
"What was the gossip?" asked Randy White.
Owen was silent. "Owen, in your own defense, for God's sake," I said.
"Shut up," he told me.
"Tell me what she said to you, Owen," the headmaster said.
"It was very ugly," said Owen Meany,
who actually thought he was protecting the President of the United States. Owen Meany was protecting the reputation of his commander-in-chief.
"Tell him, Owen," I said. "It is confidential information," Owen said. "You'll just have to believe me. She was ugly. She deserved a joke at her own expense,"
Owen said.
"Mrs. Lish says that you crudely propositioned her in front of her son. I repeat, crudely," said Randy White. "She says you were insulting, you were lewd, you were obscene, and you were anti-Semitic," the headmaster said.
"Is Mrs. Lish Jewish?" Owen asked me. "I didn't even know she was Jewish."
"She says you were anti-Semitic," the headmaster said.
"Because I propositioned her?"
Owen asked.
"Then you admit that you propositioned her?" Randy White asked him. "Suppose she'd said yes?"
Owen Meany shrugged.
"I don't know," he said thoughtfully. "I suppose I would have, wouldn't you?"
he asked me.
I nodded.
"I know you wouldn't,"
Owen said to the headmaster.
"Because you're married,"
he added.
"That was sort of the point I was making when she began to make fun of me,"
he told Randy White.
"She asked me if I'd do it with Marilyn Monroe,"
Owen explained.
"And I said, not if I were married, and she started laughing at me."
Marilyn Monroe? The headmaster said. How did Marilyn Monroe get involved in this? But Owen would say no more. Later, he told me,
Think of the scandal. Think of such a rumor leaking to the newspapers.
Did he think that the downfall of President Kennedy might come from an editorial in the Grave? Do you want to get kicked out of school for protecting the president? I asked him.
He's more important than I am, said Owen Meany.
Nowadays, I'm not sure that Owen was right about that. He was right about most things, but I'm inclined to think that Owen Meany was as worthy of protection as JFK. Look at what assholes are trying to protect the president these days. But Owen Meany could not be persuaded to protect himself. He told Dan Needham that the nature of Mrs. Lish's incitement constituted
a threat to national security.
Not even to save himself from Randy White's wrath would Owen Meany repeat what a slanderous rumor he had heard. In faculty meeting, the headmaster argued that this kind of disrespect to adults, to school parents, could not be tolerated. Mr. Early argued that there was no school rule against propositioning mothers. Owen, Mr. Early argued, had not broken a rule. The headmaster attempted to have the matter turned over to the executive committee. But Dan Needham knew that Owen's chances of survival would be poor among that group of, largely, the headmaster's henchmen. At least, they comprised the majority in any vote, as the voice had pointed out. It was not a matter for the executive committee, Dan argued. Owen had not committed an offense in any category that the school considered grounds for dismissal. Not so, said the headmaster. What about reprehensible conduct with girls? Several faculty members hastened to point out that Mitzi Lish was no girl. The headmaster then read a telegram that had been sent to him from Mrs. Lish's ex-husband, Herb. The Hollywood producer said that he hoped the insult suffered by his ex-wife and the embarrassment caused his son would not go unpunished. So put Owen on disciplinary probation, Dan Needham said. That's punishment. That's more than enough. But Randy White said there was a more serious charge against Owen than the mere propositioning of someone's mother. Did the faculty not consider anti-Semitism serious? Could a school of such a broadly based ethnic population tolerate this kind of discrimination? But Mrs. Lish had never substantiated the charge that Owen had been anti-Semitic. Even Larry Lish, when questioned, couldn't remember anything in Owen's remarks that could be construed as anti-Semitic. Larry, in fact, admitted that his mother had a habit of labeling everyone who treated her with less than complete reverence as an anti-Semite. As if, in Mrs. Lish's view, the only possible reason to dislike her was that she was Jewish. Owen, Dan Needham pointed out, hadn't even known that the Lishes were Jewish.
How could he not know? Headmaster White cried.
Dan suggested that the headmaster's remark was more anti-Semitic than any remark attributed to Owen Meany. And so he was spared. He was put on disciplinary probation for the remainder of the winter term, with the warning, understood by all, that any offense of any kind would be considered grounds for dismissal. In such a case, he would be judged by the executive committee, and none of his friends on the faculty could save him. The headmaster proposed, in addition to Owen's probation, that he be removed from his position as editor-in-chief of The Grave, or that The Voice should be silenced until the end of the winter term, or both. But this was not approved by the faculty. In truth, Mrs. Lish's charge of anti-Semitism had backfired with a number of the faculty who were quite belligerently anti-Semitic themselves. As for Randy White, Dan and Owen and I suspected that the headmaster was about as anti-Semitic as anyone we knew. And so the incident rested with Owen Meany receiving the punishment of disciplinary probation for the duration of the winter term. Aside from the jeopardy this put him in regard to any other trouble he might get into, disciplinary probation was no great imposition, especially for a day boy. Basically, he lost the senior privilege to go to Boston on Wednesday and Saturday afternoons. If he'd been a boarder, he would have lost the right to spend any weekend away from school,
but since he was a day boy, he spent every weekend at home, or with me, anyway. Yet Owen was not grateful for the leniency shown to him by the school. He was outraged that he had been punished at all. His hostility, in turn, was not appreciated by the faculty, including many of his supporters. They wanted to be congratulated for their generosity and for standing up to the headmaster. Instead, Owen cut them dead on the quadrangle paths. He greeted no one. He wouldn't even look up. He wouldn't speak, not even in class, unless spoken to. And when forced to speak, his responses were uncharacteristically brief. As for his duties as editor-in-chief of The Grave, he simply stopped contributing the column that had given The Voice his name and his fame.
"What's happened to The Voice, Owen?" Mr. Early asked him.
"The Voice has learned to keep his mouth shut,"
Owen said. "Owen," Dan Needham said, "don't piss off your friends."
"The Voice has been censored," said Owen Meany. "Just tell the faculty and the headmaster that The Voice is busy revising his valedictory. I guess no one can throw me out of school for what I say at commencement."
Thus did Owen Meany respond to his punishment, by threatening the headmaster and the faculty with The Voice. Only momentarily silenced, we all knew, but full of rage, we all were sure. It was that numbskull from Zurich, Dr. Dolder, who proposed to the faculty that Owen Meany should be required to talk with him.
"Such hostility," Dr. Dolder said. "He has a talent for speaking out, yes? And now he is withholding his talent from us. He is denying himself the pleasure of speaking his mind. Why? Without expression, his hostility will only increase, no?"
Dr. Dolder said.
"Better I should give him the opportunity to vent his hostility on me," the doctor said. "After all, we would not want a repeated incident with another older woman. Maybe this time it's a faculty wife, yes?" he said.
And so they told Owen Meany that he had to see the school psychiatrist.
"Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do," he said.
Toronto, July 14th, 1987. Still waiting for my invitation to Georgian Bay. It can't come soon enough. The New York Times appears to have reduced the Iran-Contra affair to the single issue of whether or not President Reagan knew that profits from the secret arms sales to Iran were being diverted to support the Nicaraguan Contras. Jesus Christ. Isn't it enough to know that the president wanted and intended to continue his support of the Contras after Congress told him what was enough? It makes me sick to hear the lectures delivered to Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North. What are they lecturing him for? The colonel wants to support the Contras, for the love of God and for the love of country. He's already testified that he'd do anything his commander-in-chief wanted him to do, and now we get to listen to the senators and the representatives who are running for office again. They tell the colonel all he doesn't know about the U.S. Constitution. They point out to him that patriotism is not necessarily defined as blind devotion to a president's particular agenda, and that to dispute a presidential policy is not necessarily anti-American. They might add that God is not a proven right-winger. Why are they pontificating the obvious to Colonel North? Why don't they have the balls to say this to their blessed commander-in-chief? If Hester has been paying attention to any of this, I'll bet she's throwing up. I'll bet she's barfing her brains out. She would remember, of course, those charmless bumper stickers from the Vietnam era, those cunning American flags and the red, white, and blue lettering of the name of our beloved nation. I'll bet Colonel North remembers them. "America," said the bumper stickers. "Love it or leave it." That made a lot of sense, didn't it? Remember that? And now we have to hear a civics lecture. The country's elected officials are instructing a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps on the subject that love of country and love of God and hatred of communism can conceivably be represented in a democracy by differing points of view. The colonel shows no signs of being converted.
Why are these pillars of self-righteousness wasting their breath on him? I doubt that President Reagan could be converted to democracy either. I know what my grandmother used to say. Whenever she saw or read anything, there was just a lot of bullshit. Owen picked up the phrase from her. He was quite lethal in its application our senior year at Gravesend. Whenever anyone said anything that was a lot of bullshit to him, Owen Meany used to say,
"You know what that is? That's made for television. That's what that is."
And that's what Owen would have said about the Iran-Contra hearings, concerning what President Reagan did or didn't know.
"Made for television," he would have said.
That's how he referred to his sessions with Dr. Dolder. The school made him see Dr. Dolder twice a week, and when I asked him to describe his dialogue with the Swiss idiot, Owen said,
"Made for television."
He wouldn't tell me much else about the sessions, but he liked to mock some of the questions Dr. Dolder had asked him by exaggerating the doctor's accent.
"So, you are attracted to the older women? Why is that?"
I wondered if he answered by saying he'd always been fond of my mother. Maybe he'd even been in love with her. That would have caused Dr. Dolder great excitement, I'm sure.
"So, the woman you killed mid the baseball, she made you want to proposition people's mothers, yes?"
"Come on," I said to Owen. "He's not that stupid."
"So, which faculty wife have you got your eyes on?"
"Come on," I said. "What kind of stuff does he ask you, really?"
"So, you believe in God? That's very interesting."
Owen would never tell me what really went on in those sessions. I knew Dr. Dolder was a moron, but I also knew that even a moron would have discovered some disturbing things about Owen Meany. For example, Dr. Dolder, dolt though he was, would have heard at least a little of the
"God's instrument"
theme. Even Dr. Dolder would have uncovered Owen's perplexing and troubling anti-Catholicism, and Owen's particular brand of fatalism would have been challenging for a good psychiatrist. I'm sure Dr. Dolder was scared to death about it. And would Owen have gone so far as to tell Dr. Dolder about Scrooge's grave? Would Owen have suggested that he
knew
how much time he had left on our Earth? "What do you tell him?" I asked Owen.
"The truth," said Owen Meany. "I answer every question he asks truthfully and without humor," he added.
"My God," I said, "you could really get yourself in trouble."
"Very funny,"
he said. "But Owen," I said, "you tell him everything you think about and everything you believe?" "Not everything you believe, right?" I said.
"Everything,"
said Owen Meany.
"Everything he asks."
"Jesus Christ," I said. "And what has he got to say? What's he told you?"
"He told me to talk with Pastor Merrill, so I have to see him twice a week, too," Owen said. "And with each of them, I sit there and talk about what I talked about to the other one. I guess they're finding out a lot about each other."
"I see," I said. But I didn't. Owen had taken all the Reverend Lewis Merrill's courses at the academy. He had consumed all the religion and scripture courses so voraciously that there weren't any left for him in his senior year, and Mr. Merrill had permitted him to pursue some independent study in the field. Owen was particularly interested in the miracle of the resurrection. He was interested in miracles in general, and life after death in particular, and he was writing an interminable term paper that related these subjects to that old theme from Isaiah 5:20, which he loved. "Woe unto them that call evil good and good evil." Owen's opinion of Pastor Merrill had improved considerably from those earlier years when the issue of the minister's doubt had bothered Owen's dogmatic side. Mr. Merrill had to be aware, awkwardly so, of the role the voice had played in securing his appointment as school minister. When they sat together in Pastor Merrill's vestry office, I couldn't imagine them, not either of them, as being quite at ease. Yet there appeared to be much respect between them. Owen did not have a relaxing effect on anyone, and no one I knew was ever less relaxed than the Reverend Lewis Merrill, and so I imagined that Hurd's church would be creaking excessively during their interviews, or whatever they called them. They would both be fidgeting away in the vestry office, Mr. Merrill opening and closing the old desk drawers and sliding that old chair on the casters from one end of the desk to the other, while Owen Meany cracked his knuckles, crossed and uncrossed his little legs, and shrugged and sighed and reached out his hands to the Reverend Mr. Merrill's desk, if only to pick up a paperweight or a prayer book and put it down again. "What do you talk about with Mr. Merrill?" I asked him.
"I talk about Dr. Dolder with Pastor Merrill, and I talk about Pastor Merrill with Dr. Dolder,"
Owen said. "No, but I know you like Pastor Merrill. I mean, sort of. Don't you?" I asked him.
"We talk about life after death," said Owen Meany.
"I see," I said. But I didn't. I didn't realize the degree to which Owen Meany never got tired of talking about that. Toronto, July 21st, 1987. It is a scorcher in town today. I was getting my hair cut in my usual place near the corner of Bathurst and St. Clair, and the girl barber, something I'll never get used to, asked me the usual. "How short?" "As short as Oliver North's," I said.
"Who?"
she said. "Oh, Canada. But I'm sure there are young girls cutting hair in the United States who don't know who Colonel North is either. And in a few years, almost no one will remember him. How many people remember Melvin Laird? How many people remember General Creighton Abrams or General William Westmoreland, not to mention which one replaced the other? And who replaced General Maxwell Taylor? Who replaced General Curtis LeMay? And whom did Ellsworth Bunker replace? Remember that? Of course you don't." There was a terrible din of construction going on outside the barber shop at the corner of Bathurst and St. Clair, but I was sure that my girl barber had heard me. "Oliver North," I repeated. "Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, United States Marine Corps," I said. "I guess you want it really short," she said. "Yes, please," I said. "I've simply got to stop reading the New York Times. There's nothing in the news that's worth remembering. Why, then, do I have such a hard time forgetting it?" No one had a memory like Owen Meany. By the end of the winter term of 62, I'll bet he never once confused what he'd said to Dr. Dolder with what he'd said to the Reverend Lewis Merrill. But I'll bet they were confused. By the end of the winter term, I'll bet they thought that either he should have been thrown out of school, or he should have been made the new headmaster. By the end of every winter term at Gravesend Academy, the New Hampshire weather had driven everyone half crazy. Who doesn't get tired of getting up in the dark? And in Owen's case, he had to get up earlier than most. Because of his scholarship job as a faculty waiter, he had to arrive in the dining hall kitchen at least 1 hour before breakfast on those mornings he waited on tables. The waiters had to set the tables and eat their own breakfasts in the kitchen before the other students and the faculty arrived. Then they had to clear the tables between the official end of breakfast and the beginning of morning meeting, as the new headmaster had so successfully called what used to be our morning chapel. That Saturday morning in February, the tomato red pickup was dead, and he'd had to jumpstart the Meany Granite Company trailer truck and get it rolling down Maiden Hill before it would start. It was so cold. He did not like to have dining hall duty, as it was called, on the weekend, and there was the added problem of him being a day boy and having to drive himself that extra distance to school. I guess he was cross when he got there, and there was another car parked in the circular driveway by the main academy building where he always parked. The trailer truck was so big that the presence of only one other car in the circular driveway would force him to park the truck out on Front Street. And in the winter months, there was a ban regarding parking on Front Street, a snow removal restriction that the town imposed, and Owen was hopping mad about that, too. The car that kept Owen from parking his truck in the circular driveway adjacent to the main academy building was Dr. Dolder's Volkswagen Beetle. In keeping with the lovable and exasperating tidiness of his countrymen, Dr. Dolder was exact and predictable about his little VW. His bachelor apartment was in Quincy Hall, a dormitory on the far side of the Gravesend campus. It seemed to be the far side from everywhere, but it was as far from the main academy building as you could get and still be on the Gravesend campus. Dr. Dolder parked his VW by the main academy building only when he'd been drinking. He was a frequent dinner guest of Randy and Sam White's. He parked by the main academy building when he ate with the Whites, and when he drank too much, he left his car there and walked home. The campus was not so large that he couldn't or shouldn't have walked both ways, to dinner and back, but Dr. Dolder was one of those Europeans who had fallen in love with a most American peculiarity, how Americans will walk nowhere if they can drive there. In Zurich, I'm sure, Dr. Dolder walked everywhere. But he drove his little VW across the Gravesend campus as if he were touring the New England states. Whenever Dr. Dolder's VW was parked in the circular driveway by the main academy building, everyone knew that the doctor was simply exercising his especially Swiss prudence. He was not a drunk, and the few small roads he might have traveled on to drive himself from dinner at the Whites to Quincy Hall would not have given him much opportunity to maim many of the sober and innocent residents of Gravesend. There's a good chance he would never have encountered anyone. But Dr. Dolder loved his beetle, and he was a cautious man. Once, in the fresh snow upon his Volkswagen's windshield, a first-year German student had written with his finger, "Herr Dr. Dolder hat zu viel betrunken." I could usually tell, when I saw Owen either at breakfast or at morning meeting, if Dr. Dolder had had too much to drink the night before. If it was winter, and if Owen was surly-looking, I knew he'd faced an early morning parking problem. I knew when the pickup had failed to start, and there was no room for him to park the trailer truck, just by looking at him. "What's up?" I would ask him.
"That tight-ass, tipsy Swiss dink,"
Owen Meany would say. "I see," I would say. And this particular February morning, I can imagine how the Swiss psychiatrist beetle would have affected him. I guess Owen must have been sitting in the frigid cab of the truck. You could drive that big hauler for an hour before you'd even notice that the heater was on. And I'll bet he was smoking, and probably talking to himself, too, when he looked into the path of his headlights and saw about three-quarters of the basketball team walking his way. In the cold air, their breathing must have made him think that they were smoking, too, although he knew all of them and knew they didn't smoke. He entertained them at least two or three times a week by his devotion to practicing the shot. He told me later that there were about 8 or 10 basketball players, not quite the whole team. All of them lived in the same dorm. It was one of the traditional jock dorms on the campus, and because the basketball team was playing at some faraway school, they were on their way to the dining hall for an early breakfast with the waiters who had dining hall duty. They were big, happy guys with goofy strides, and they didn't mind being out of bed before it was light. They were going to miss their Saturday morning classes, and they saw the whole day as an adventure. Owen Meany was not quite in such a cheerful mood. He rolled down the window of the big truck's frosty cab and called them over. They were friendly and, as always, extremely glad to see him, and they jumped onto the flatbed of the trailer and roughhoused with each other, pushing each other off the flatbed and so forth.
"You guys look very strong today," said Owen Meany,
and they hooted in agreement. In the path of the truck's headlights, the innocent shape of Dr. Dolder's Volkswagen Beetle stood encased in ice and dusted very lightly with last night's snow.
"I'll bet you guys aren't strong enough to pick up that Volkswagen," said Owen Meany.
But of course, they were strong enough. They were not only strong enough to lift Dr. Dolder's beetle, they were strong enough to carry it out of town. The captain of the basketball team was an agreeable giant. When Owen practiced the shot with this guy, the captain lifted Owen with one hand. "No problem," the captain said to Owen. "Where do you want it?" Owen swore to me that it wasn't until that moment that he got
the idea.
It's clear to me that Owen never overcame his irritation with Randy White for moving morning chapel from Hurd's Church to the main academy building and calling it morning meeting, that he still thought of that as the headmaster's
grandstanding.
The sets for Dan's winter term play had already been dismantled. The stage of the Great Hall, as it was called, was bare. And that broad, sweeping marble stairway that led up to the Great Hall's triumphant double doors, all of that, Owen was sure, was big enough to permit the easy entrance of Dr. Dolder's Volkswagen. And wouldn't that be something, to have that perky little automobile parked on center stage, a kind of cheerful, harmless message to greet the headmaster and the entire student body, a little something to make them smile as the dog days of March bore down upon us and the long-awaited break for spring vacation could not come soon enough to save us all.
"Carry it into the main academy building,"
Owen Meany told the captain of the basketball team.
"Take it upstairs to the Great Hall and carry it up on the stage," said the voice. "Put it right in the middle of the stage, facing forward, right next to the headmaster's podium. But be careful you don't scratch it, and for God's sake, don't drop it. Don't put a mark on anything," he cautioned the basketball players. "Don't do the slightest damage. Not to the car and not to the stairs, not to the doors of the Great Hall, not to the stage," he said. "Make it look like it flew up there," he told them. "Make it look like an angel drove it on stage," said Owen Meany.
When the basketball players carried off Dr. Dolder's Volkswagen, Owen thought very carefully about using the available parking space. He decided it was wiser to drive all the way over to Waterhouse Hall and park next to Dan's car instead. Not even Dan saw him park the truck there, and if anyone had seen him running across the campus as it was growing light, that would not have seemed strange. He was just a faculty waiter with dining hall duty hurrying so he wouldn't be late. He ate his breakfast in the dining hall kitchen with the other waiters and with an extraordinarily hungry and jolly bunch of basketball players. Owen was setting the head faculty table when the captain of the basketball team said goodbye to him. "There wasn't the slightest damage, not to anything," the captain assured him.
"Have a good game," said Owen Meany.
It was one of the janitors in the main academy building who discovered the Beatle on stage when he was raising the blinds on the high windows that welcomed so much morning light into the Great Hall. Naturally, the janitor called the headmaster. From the kitchen window of the obtrusive house, directly across from the main academy building, Headmaster White could see the small rectangle of bare ground where Dr. Dolder's Volkswagen had spent the night. According to Dan Needham, the headmaster called him while he was getting out of the shower. Most of the faculty made breakfast for themselves at home, or they skipped breakfast rather than eat in the school dining hall. The headmaster told Dan that he was rounding up all able-bodied faculty for the purpose of removing Dr. Dolder's Volkswagen from the stage of the Great Hall before morning meeting. The students, the headmaster told Dan, were not going to have the last laugh. Dan said he didn't feel particularly able-bodied himself, but he'd certainly try to help out. When he hung up the phone, he was laughing to himself. Until he looked out the window of Waterhouse Hall and saw the Meany Granite Company trailer truck parked next to his own car. Dan suddenly thought that
the idea
of putting Dr. Dolder's Volkswagen on the stage of the Great Hall had Owen Meany's name written all over it. That was exactly what the headmaster said when he and about a dozen not very able-bodied faculty members, along with a few hefty faculty wives, were struggling with Dr. Dolder's Beetle.
"This has Owen Meany's name written all over it," the headmaster said.
"I don't think Owen could lift a Volkswagen," Dan Needham ventured cautiously.
"I mean the idea," the headmaster said.
As Dan describes it, the faculty were ill-trained for lifting anything. Even the athletic types were neither as strong nor as flexible as young basketball players, and they should have considered something basic to their task. It is much easier to carry something heavy and awkward upstairs than it is to lug it down. Mr. Tubulary, the track and field coach, was overzealous in his descent of the stairs from the stage. He fell off and landed on the hard wooden bench in the front row of assembled seats. A hymnal, fortunately, cushioned the blow to his head, or he might have been knocked senseless. Dan Needham described Mr. Tubulary as already senseless before his fall, but the track and field coach severely sprained his ankle in the mishap and had to be carried to the Hubbard Infirmary. That left even fewer less-than-able-bodied faculty, and some beefy wives, to deal with the unfortunate wreck of Dr. Dolder's Volkswagen, which now stood on its rear end, which is a Beetle's heavy end, where its engine is. The little car, standing so oddly upright, appeared to be saluting or applauding the weary faculty who had so ungracefully dropped it off stage. "It's a good thing Dr. Dolder isn't here," Dan observed. Because the headmaster was so riled up, no one wished to point out the obvious, that they would have been better off to let the students have the last laugh. Then the faculty could have ordered a strong, healthy bunch of students to carry the car safely off stage. If the students wrecked the car in the course of its removal from the main academy building, then the students would have been responsible. As it was, things went from bad to worse, as they often will when amateurs are involved in an activity that they perform in bad temper and in a hurry. The students would be arriving for morning meeting in another 10 or 15 minutes. A smashed Volkswagen, sitting on its rear end, in the front of the Great Hall, might very well produce a louder and longer laugh than a natty, well-cared-for car facing them, undamaged, on stage. But there was brief discussion, if any, of this. The headmaster, bright red in the face with the strain of lifting the solid little German marvel of the highways, urged the faculty to put their muscles into the chore and spare him their comments. But there had been ice and a little snow on the VW. This was melted now. The car was wet and slippery. Puddles of water were underfoot. One of the faculty wives, one especially prolific with progeny, and one whose maternal girth was more substantial than well-coordinated, slipped under the Volkswagen as it was being returned to its wheels. Although she was not hurt, she was wedged quite securely under the stubborn automobile. Volkswagens were pioneers in sealing the bottoms of their cars, and the poor faculty wife discovered that there was no gap beneath the car that would allow her to wriggle free. This presented, with less than 10 minutes before morning meeting, a new humiliation for the headmaster. Dr. Dolder's damaged Volkswagen, leaking its engine and transmission oil upon the prostrate body of a trapped faculty wife. She was not an especially popular faculty wife among the students, either.
"Jesus fucking Christ," said Randy White.
Some of the early nerds were already arriving. Early nerds were students who were so eager for the school day to begin that they got to morning meeting long before the time they were required to be there. I don't know what they are called today, but I'm sure that such students are never called anything nice. Some of these early nerds were quite startled to be shouted at by the headmaster, telling them to come back at the proper time. Meanwhile, in tilting the VW to its side, enough to allow the safe deliverance of the rotund faculty wife, the inexperienced car handlers tilted the Beetle too far. It fell flat on the driver's side. There went that window and that side-view mirror. The debris, together with the taillight glass from the VW's inexpert fall from the stage, was hastily swept under the front row wooden bench where the injured Mr. Tubulary had fallen. Someone suggested getting Dr. Dolder. If the doctor unlocked the car, the stalwart vehicle could be rolled, if not driven, to the head of the broad and sweeping marble stairway. Perhaps it would be easier to navigate the staircase with someone inside, behind the wheel.
"Nobody's calling Dolder,"
the headmaster cried. Someone pointed out that, since the window was broken, it was, in any case, an unnecessary step. Also, someone else pointed out, the Volkswagen could not be driven or rolled on its side. Better to solve that problem. But according to Dan, the untrained faculty were unaware of their own strength. In attempting to right the car upon its wheels, they heaved too hard and tossed it from the driver's side to the passenger side, flattening the front row wooden bench, and there went the passenger side window and the other side view mirror. "Perhaps we should cancel morning meeting," Dan Needham cautiously suggested. But the headmaster, to everyone's astonishment, actually righted the Volkswagen upon its wheels by himself. I guess his adrenal glands were pumping. Randy White then seized his lower back with both hands and dropped, cursing, to his knees.
"Don't touch me," the headmaster cried. "I'm fine," he said, grimacing, and coming unsteadily to his feet.
He sharply kicked the rear fender of Dr. Dolder's car. Then he reached through the hole where the driver's side window had been and unlocked the door. He sat behind the wheel, with apparent jolts of extreme discomfort assailing him from the region of his lower back, and commanded the faculty to push him.
"Where?" Dan Needham asked the headmaster. "Down the Jesus fucking Christly stairs!" Headmaster White cried.
And so they pushed him. There was little point in trying to reason with him, Dan Needham later explained. The bell for morning meeting was already ringing when Randy White began his bumpy descent of the broad and sweeping marble stairway. Several students, normal students in addition to the early nerds, were milling around in the foyer of the main academy building at the foot of the staircase. Who can really piece together all the details of such a case? I mean, who can ever get straight what happened exactly? It was an emotional moment for the headmaster, and there is no overestimating the pain in his lower back. He had lifted the car all by himself, whether his back muscles went into spasms while he was attempting to steer the VW downstairs, or whether he suffered the spasms after his spectacular accident. Well, this is academic, isn't it? Suffice it to say that the students in the foyer fled from the wildly approaching little vehicle. No doubt the melted snow and ice were on the Beetle's tires, too, and marble, as everyone knows, is slippery. This way and that way, the dynamic little car hopped down the staircase. Great slabs of marble appeared to leap off the polished handrails of the stairway, the result of the Volkswagen's gouging out hunks of marble as it skidded from side to side. There's an old New Hampshire phrase that is meant to express extreme fragility and damage. Like a robin's egg rolling down the spout of a rain gutter. Thus did the headmaster descend the marble staircase from the great hall to the foyer of the main academy building, except that he didn't quite arrive at his destination. The car flipped and landed on its roof and jammed itself sideways and upside down in the middle of the stairway. The doors could not be opened, nor could the headmaster be removed from the wreckage. Such spasms assailed his lower back that he could not contort himself into the necessary posture to make an exit from the car through the space where the windshield had been. Randy White, sitting upside down and holding fast to the steering wheel, cried out that there was a conspiracy of students and faculty who were, clearly, against him. He said numerous unprintable things about Dr. Dolder's fussy fucking drinking habits, about all German-manufactured cars, about what wimps and pussies were masquerading as able-bodied among the faculty and their wives, and he shouted and screamed that his back was killing him until his wife, Sam, could be brought to the scene, where she knelt on the chipped marble stairs and gave her upside-down husband what comfort she could. Professionals were summoned to extricate him from the destroyed Volkswagen. Later, long after morning meeting was over, they finally rescued the headmaster by removing the driver's side door of Dr. Dolder's poor car with a torch. The headmaster was confined to the Hubbard Infirmary for the remainder of the day. The nurses and the school doctor wanted to keep him, for observation, overnight, but the headmaster threatened to fire all of them if he was not released. Over and over again, Randy White was heard to shout or cry out or mutter to his wife,
"This has Owen Meany's name written all over it!"
It was an interesting morning meeting, that morning. We were more than twice as long, being seated because only one staircase ascending to the Great Hall was available for our passage, and then there was the problem of the front row bench being smashed. The boys who regularly sat there had to find places for themselves on the floor or on stage. There were crushed beads of glass and chipped paint and puddles of engine and transmission oil everywhere, and except for the opening and closing hymn, which drowned out the cries of the trapped headmaster, we were forced to listen to the ongoing drama on the stairway. I'm afraid this distracted us from the Reverend Mr. Merrill's prayer and from Mr. Early's annual pep talk to the seniors. We should not allow our anxieties about our pending college admission, or our rejection, to keep us from having a good spring holiday, Mr. Early advised us.
"Goddamn Jesus fucking Christ! Keep that blowtorch away from my face!"
we all heard the headmaster cry. And at the end of morning meeting, the headmaster's wife, Sam, shouted at those students who attempted to descend the blocked staircase by climbing over the ruined Volkswagen, in which the headmaster was still imprisoned.
"Where are your manners?" Mrs. White shouted.
It was after morning meeting, before I had a chance to speak to Owen Meany. "I don't suppose you had anything to do with all of that?" I asked him.
"Faith and prayer," he said. "Faith and prayer. They work. They really do."
Toronto, July 23rd, 1987. Catherine invited me to her island. No more stupid newspapers. I'm going to Georgian Bay. Another stinking hot day. Meanwhile, on the front page of the Globe and Mail, it must be a slow day, there's a story about Sweden's Supreme Court making legal history. The Supreme Court is hearing an appeal in a custody case involving a dead cat. What a world.
Made for television.
I haven't been to church in more than a month. Too many newspapers. Newspapers are a bad habit, the reading equivalent of junk food. What happens to me is that I seize upon an issue in the news. The issue is the moral, philosophical, political, intellectual equivalent of a cheeseburger with everything on it. But for the duration of my interest in it, all my other interests are consumed by it, and whatever appetites and capacities I may have had for detachment and reflection are suddenly subordinate to this cheeseburger in my life. I offer this as self-criticism, but what it means to be political is that you welcome these obsessions with cheeseburgers at great cost to the rest of your life. I remember the independent study that Owen Meany was conducting with Reverend Lewis Merrill in the winter term of 1962. I wonder if those cheeseburgers in the Reagan administration are familiar with Isaiah 5:20. As the voice would say,
"Woe unto them that call evil good and good evil."
After me, Pastor Merrill was the first to ask Owen if he'd had anything to do with the accident to Dr. Dolder's Volkswagen. The unfortunate little car would spend our entire spring vacation in the body shop.
"Do I understand correctly that the subject of our conversation is confidential?"
Owen asked Pastor Merrill.
"You know what I mean? Like you're the priest and I'm the confessor? And short of murder, you won't repeat what I tell you?"
Owen Meany asked him. "You understand correctly, Owen," the Reverend Mr. Merrill said.
"It was my idea," Owen said, "but I didn't lift a finger. I didn't even set foot in the building, not even to watch them do it."
"Who did it?" Mr. Merrill asked.
"Most of the basketball team," said Owen Meany. "They just happened along."
"It was completely spur of the moment?" asked Mr. Merrill.
"Out of the blue! It happened in a flash! You know, like the burning bush," Owen said.
"Well, "Not quite like that, I think," said the Reverend Mr. Merrill, who assured Owen that he only wanted to know the particulars so that he could make every effort to steer the headmaster away from Owen, who was Randy White's prime suspect. "It helps," said Pastor Merrill, "if I can tell the headmaster that I know for a fact that you didn't touch Dr. Dolder's car or set foot in the building, as you say."
"Don't rat on the basketball team either," Owen said.
"Of course not," said Mr. Merrill, who added that he didn't think Owen should be as candid with Dr. Dolder, should the doctor inquire if Owen knew anything about the accident. As much as it was understood that the subject of conversation between a psychiatrist and his patient was also confidential, Owen should understand the degree to which the fastidious Swiss gentleman had cared for his car.
"I know what you mean," said Owen Meany.
Dan Needham, who said to Owen that he didn't want to hear a word about what Owen did or didn't know about Dr. Dolder's car, told us that the headmaster was screaming to the faculty about disrespect for personal property and vandalism. Both categories of crimes fell under the rubric of punishable by dismissal.
"It was the headmaster and the faculty who trashed the Volkswagen," Owen pointed out. "There wasn't anything the matter with that car until the headmaster and those oafs got their hands on it."
"As one of those oafs, I don't want to know how you know that, Owen," Dan told him. "I want you to be very careful what you say to anybody." There were only a few days left before the end of the winter term, which would also mark the end of Owen Meany's disciplinary probation. Once the spring term started, Owen could afford a few small lapses in his adherence to school rules. He wasn't much of a rule breaker, anyway. Dr. Dolder, naturally, saw what had happened to his car as a crowning example of the hostility he often felt from the students. Dr. Dolder was extremely sensitive to both real and imagined hostility because not a single student at Gravesend Academy was known to seek the psychiatrist's advice willingly. Dr. Dolder's only patients were either required by the school or forced by their parents to see him. In their first session together following the destruction of his VW, Dr. Dolder began with Owen by saying to him, "I know you hate me, yes? But why do you hate me?"
"I hate having to talk with you," Owen admitted. "But I don't hate you. Nobody hates you, Dr. Dolder."
"And what did he say when you said that?" I asked Owen Meany.
"He was quiet for a long time. I think he was crying," Owen said.
"Jesus," I said.
"I think that the Academy is at a low point in its history," Owen observed.
That was so typical of him, that in the midst of a precarious situation, he would suggest, as a subject for criticism, something far removed from himself. But there was no hard evidence against him. Not even the zeal of the headmaster could put the blame for the demolished Beetle on Owen Meany. Then, as soon as that scare was behind him, there was a worse problem. Larry Lish was busted while trying to buy beer at a local grocery store. The manager of the store had confiscated Lish's fake identification, the phony draft card that falsified his age, and called the police. Lish admitted that the draft card had been created from a blank card in the editorial offices of The Grave. His illegal identification had been invented on the photocopier. According to Lish, countless Gravesend Academy students had acquired fake draft cards in this fashion.
"And whose idea was that?" the headmaster asked him.
"Not mine," said Larry Lish. "I bought my card, like everyone else." I can only imagine that the headmaster was trembling with excitement. This interrogation took place in the police department offices of Gravesend's own chief of police, our old murder weapon and instrument of death man, Chief Ben Pike. Chief Pike had already informed Larry Lish that falsifying a draft card carried criminal charges.
"Who was selling and making these fake draft cards, Larry?" Randy White asked.
Larry Lish would make his mother proud of him. I have no doubt about that.
"Owen Meany," said Larry Lish.
And so, The spring vacation of 1962 did not come quite soon enough. The headmaster made a deal with Police Chief Pike. No criminal charges would be brought against anyone at the academy if the headmaster could turn over to Chief Pike all the fake draft cards at the school. That was pretty easy. The headmaster told every boy at morning meeting to leave his wallet on the stage before he left the Great Hall. Boys without their wallets would return immediately to their dormitory rooms and hand them over to an attendant faculty member. Every boy's wallet would be returned to him in his post office box. There were no morning classes. The faculty was too busy looking through each boy's wallet and removing his fake draft card. In the emergency faculty meeting that Randy White called, Dan Needham said, "What you're doing isn't even legal. Every parent of every boy at this school should sue you." But the headmaster argued that he was sparing the school the disgrace of having criminal charges brought against Gravesend students. The academy's reputation as a good school would not suffer by this action of confiscation as much as that reputation would suffer from criminal charges. And as for the criminal, who had actually manufactured and sold these false identification cards for a profit, naturally, the headmaster said, that student's fate would be decided by the executive committee. And so they crucified him. It happened that quickly. It didn't matter that he told them he had given up his illegal enterprise. It didn't matter to them that he said he had been inspired to correct his behavior by JFK's inaugural speech, or that he knew the fake draft cards were being used to illegally purchase alcohol and that he didn't approve of drinking. It didn't matter to them that he didn't even drink. Larry Lish and everyone in possession of a fake draft card was put on disciplinary probation for the duration of the spring term. But the executive committee crucified Owen Meany. They axed him. They gave him the boot. They threw him out. Dan tried to block Owen's dismissal by calling for a special vote among the faculty, but the headmaster said that the executive committee decision was final, vote or no vote. Mr. Early telephoned each member of the Board of Trustees. But there were only 2 days remaining in the winter term. The trustees could not possibly be assembled before the spring vacation, and they would not overrule an executive committee decision without a proper meeting. The decision to throw Owen Meany out of school was so unpopular that the former headmaster, old Archibald Thorndike, emerged from his retirement to express his disapproval. Old Archie told one of the students who wrote for The Grave and a reporter from the town paper, The Gravesend Newsletter, that Owen Meany is one of the best citizens the Academy has ever produced. "I expect great things from that little fella," the former headmaster said. Old Thorny also disapproved of what he called the Gestapo methods of seizing the students' billfolds, and he questioned Randy White's tactics on the grounds that they did little to teach respect for personal property. "That old fart," Dan Needham said. "I know he means well, but no one listened to him when he was headmaster. No one's going to listen to him now." In Dan's opinion, it was self-serving to credit the Academy with producing students. Least of all, Dan said, could the Academy claim to have produced Owen Meany. And regarding the merits of teaching respect for personal property, that was an old-fashioned idea, and the word billfolds, in Dan's opinion, was outdated. Although Dan agreed with old Archibald Thorndike that Randy White's tactics were pure Gestapo. All this talk did nothing for Owen. The Reverend Lewis Merrill called Dan and me and asked us if we knew where Owen was. Pastor Merrill had been trying to reach him. But whenever anyone called the Meany's house, either the line was busy, probably the receiver was off the hook, or else Mr. Meany answered the phone and said that he thought Owen was in Durham. That meant he was with Hester. But when I called her, she wouldn't admit he was there. "Have you got some good news for him?" she asked me. "Is that fucking creep school going to let him graduate?" "No," I said. "I don't have any good news." "Then just leave him alone," she suggested. Later, I heard Dan on the telephone, talking to the headmaster. You're the worst thing that ever happened to this school, Dan told Randy White. If you survive this disaster, I won't be staying here, and I won't leave alone. You've permitted yourself a fatal and childish indulgence. You've done something one of the boys might do. You've engaged in a kind of combat with a student. You've been competing with one of the kids. You're such a kid yourself, you let Owen Meany get to you. Because a kid took a dislike to you, you decided to pay him back. That's just the way a kid thinks. You're not grown up enough to run a school. And this was a scholarship boy, Dan Needham yelled in the telephone. This is a boy who's going to go to college on a scholarship, too, or else he won't go. If Owen Meany doesn't get the best deal possible from the best college around, you're responsible for that, too. Then I think the headmaster hung up on him. At least it appeared to me that Dan Needham had much more to say, but he suddenly stopped talking, and slowly he returned the receiver to its cradle. Shit, he said. Later that night, my grandmother called Dan and me to say that she had heard from Owen.
Mrs. Wheelwright?
Owen had said to her, over the phone.
Where are you, Owen? She asked him.
It doesn't matter, he told her. I just wanted to say I was sorry that I let you down. I don't want you to think I'm not grateful for the opportunity you gave me to go to a good school.
It doesn't sound like such a good school to me. Not anymore, Owen, my grandmother told him.
And you didn't let me down.
I promised to make you proud of me,
Owen told her.
I am proud of you, Owen, she told him.
I'm going to make you prouder, Owen said.
Then, almost as an afterthought, he said,
Please tell Dan and John to be sure to go to chapel in the morning.
That was just like him, to call it chapel, after everyone else had been converted to calling it morning meeting.
Whatever he's going to do, we should try to stop him, Dan told me. He shouldn't do anything that might make it worse. He's got to concentrate on getting into college and getting a scholarship. I'm sure that Gravesend High School will give him a diploma, but he shouldn't do anything crazy. Naturally, we still couldn't locate him. Mr. Meany said he was in Durham. Hester said she didn't know where he was. She thought he was doing some job for his father because he had been driving the big truck, not the pickup, and he was carrying a lot of equipment on the flatbed. What sort of equipment? I asked her. How would I know? She said. It was just a lot of heavy-looking stuff.
Jesus Christ, said Dan. He's probably going to dynamite the headmaster's house.
We drove all around the town and the campus, but there was no sign of him or the big truck. We drove in and out of town a couple of times and up Maiden Hill to the quarries just to see if the hauler was safely back at home. It wasn't. We drove around all night.
Think, Dan instructed me. What will he do?
I don't know, I said. We were coming back into town, passing the gas station next to St. Michael's School. The pre-dawn light had a flattering effect on the shabby parochial playground. The early light bathed the ruts in the ruptured macadam and made the surface of the playground appear as smooth as the surface of a lake, unruffled by any wind. The house where the nuns lived was completely dark, and then the sun rose. A pink sliver of light lay flat upon the playground, and the newly whitewashed stone archway that sheltered the statue of the sainted Mary Magdalene reflected the pink light brightly back to me. The only problem was, the holy goalie was not in her goal.
Stop the car, I said to Dan. He stopped.
He turned around. We drove into the parking lot behind St. Michael's, and Dan inched the car out onto the rutted surface of the playground. He drove right up to the empty stone archway. Owen had done a very neat job. At the time, I wasn't sure of the equipment he would have used, maybe those funny little chisels and spreaders, the things he called wedges and feathers. But the tap-tap-tap of metal on stone would have awakened the ever-vigilant nuns. Maybe he used one of those special granite saws. The blade is diamond-studded. I'm sure it would have done a faultless job of taking Mary Magdalene clean off her feet. Actually, he'd taken her feet clean off her pedestal. It's even possible that he used a touch of dynamite, artfully placed, of course. I wouldn't put it past him to have devised a way to blast the sainted Mary Magdalene off her pedestal. I'm sure he could have muffled the explosion so skillfully that the nuns would have slept right through it. Later, when I asked him how he did it, he would give me his usual answer.
Faith and prayer! Faith and prayer! They work! They really do!
That statue's got to weigh 300 or 400 pounds, Dan Needham said. Surely, the heavy equipment that Hester had seen would have included some kind of hydraulic hoist or crane, although that wouldn't have helped him get Mary Magdalene up the long staircase in the main academy building, or up on the stage of the Great Hall. He would have had to use a hand dolly for that, and it wouldn't have been easy.
"I've moved heavier gravestones,"
he would say later. But I don't imagine he was in the habit of moving gravestones upstairs. When Dan and I got to the main academy building and climbed to the Great Hall, the janitor was already sitting on one of the front row benches, just staring up at the saintly figure. It was as if the janitor thought that Mary Magdalene would speak to him, if he would be patient enough. Even though Dan and I immediately noticed that Mary was not her usual self.
"It's him who did it. That little fellow they threw out, don't you suppose?" the janitor asked Dan, who was speechless.
We sat beside the janitor on the front row bench in the early light. As always, with Owen Meany, there was the necessary consideration of the symbols involved. He had removed Mary Magdalene's arms above the elbows so that her gesture of beseeching the assembled audience would seem all the more an act of supplication and all the more helpless. Dan and I both knew that Owen suffered an obsession with armlessness. This was Wadahantowit's familiar totem. This was what Owen had done to my armadillo. My mother's dressmaker's dummy was armless, too. But neither Dan nor I was prepared for Mary Magdalene being headless. For her head was cleanly sawed or chiseled or blasted off. Because my mother's dummy was also headless, I thought that Mary Magdalene bore her a stony 300 or 400 pound resemblance. My mother had the better figure, but Mary Magdalene was taller. She was also taller than the headmaster, even without her head. Compared to Randy White, the decapitated Mary Magdalene was a little bigger than life-sized. Her shoulders and the stump of her neck stood taller above the podium on stage than the headmaster would, and Owen had placed the holy goalie on no pedestal. He had bolted her to the stage floor, and he had strapped her with those same steel bands the quarrymen used to hold the granite slabs on the flatbed. He had bound her to the podium and fastened her to the floor, making quite certain that she would not be as easily removed from the stage as Dr. Dolder's Volkswagen. "I suppose," Dan said to the janitor, "that those metal bands are pretty securely attached?"
"Yup,"
the janitor said. "I suppose those bolts go right through the podium and right through the stage," Dan said. "And I'll bet he put those nuts on pretty tight."
"Nope," the janitor said. "He welded everything together."
"That's pretty tight," said Dan Needham.
"Yup,"
the janitor said. I had forgotten. Owen had learned welding. Mr. Meany had wanted at least one of his quarrymen to be a welder, and Owen, who was such a natural at learning, had been the one to learn.
"Have you told the headmaster?" Dan asked the janitor.
"Nope,"
the janitor said. "I ain't going to either," he said. "Not this time."
"I suppose it wouldn't do any good for him to know anyway," Dan said.
"That's what I thought," the janitor said.
Dan and I went to the school dining hall, where we were unfamiliar faces at breakfast, but we were very hungry after driving around all night, and besides, I wanted to pass the word. "Tell everyone to get to morning meeting a little early," I told my friends. I heard Dan passing the word to some of his friends on the faculty. If you go to only one morning meeting for the rest of your life, I think this should be the one. Dan and I left the dining hall together. There wasn't time to return to Waterhouse Hall and take a shower before morning meeting, although we badly needed one. We were both anxious for Owen and agitated, not knowing how his presentation of the mutilated Mary Magdalene might make his dismissal from the academy appear more justified than it was. We were worried how his desecration of the statue of a saint might give those colleges and universities that were sure to accept him a certain reluctance. Not to mention what the Catholic Church, I mean St. Michael's, is going to do to him, Dan said. I better have a talk with the head guy over there, Father What's-His-Name. Do you know him? I asked Dan. No, not really, Dan said. But I think he's a friendly sort of fellow, Father O'Somebody, I think. I wish I could remember his name. O'Malley, O'Leary, O'Rourke, O'Somebody, he said. I'll bet Pastor Merrill knows him, I said. And that was why Dan and I walked to Herge Church before morning meeting. Sometimes the Reverend Lewis Merrill said his prayers there before walking to the main academy building. Sometimes he was up early, just biding his time in the vestry office. Dan and I saw the trailer truck from the Meany Granite Company parked behind the vestry. Owen was sitting in the vestry office, in Mr. Merrill's usual chair, behind Mr. Merrill's desk, tipping back in the creaky old chair and rolling the chair around on its squeaky casters. There was no sign of Pastor Merrill.
I have an early appointment,
Owen explained to Dan and me.
Pastor Merrill's a little late.
He looked all right, a little tired, a little nervous, or just restless. He couldn't sit still in the chair, and he fiddled with the desk drawers, pulling them open and closing them, not appearing to pay any attention to what was inside the drawers, but just opening and closing them because they were there. You've had a busy night, Owen, Dan told him.
Pretty busy, said Owen Meany.
How are you? I asked him.
I'm fine, he said. I broke the law. I got caught. I'm going to pay. That's how it is, he said.
You got screwed, I said.
A little bit,
he nodded. Then he shrugged.
It's not as if I'm entirely innocent, he added.
The important thing for you to think about is getting into college, Dan told him. The important thing is that you get in and that you get a scholarship.
There are more important things, said Owen Meany.
He opened, in rapid succession, the three drawers on the right-hand side of the Reverend Mr. Merrill's desk. Then he closed them, just as rapidly. That was when Pastor Merrill walked into the vestry office. What are you doing? Mr. Merrill asked Owen.
Nothing, said Owen Meany. Waiting for you.
I mean at my desk. You're sitting at my desk, Mr. Merrill said. Owen looked surprised.
I got here early, he explained. I was just sitting in your chair. I wasn't doing anything.
He got up and walked to the front of Pastor Merrill's desk, where he sat down in his usual chair. At least, I guess it was his usual chair. It reminded me of the singer's seat in Graham McSwiney's funny studio. I was disappointed that I hadn't heard from Mr. McSwiney. I guessed that he had no news about Big Black Buster Freebody. I'm sorry if I snapped at you, Owen, Pastor Merrill said. I know how upset you must be.
I'm fine, Owen said.
I was glad you called me, Mr. Merrill told Owen. Owen shrugged. I had not seen him sneer before, but it seemed to me that he almost sneered at the Reverend Mr. Merrill. Oh, well, Mr. Merrill said, sitting down in his creaky desk chair. Well, I'm very sorry, Owen, for everything, he said. He had a way of entering a room, a classroom, the Great Hall, Herge Church, or even his own vestry office, as if he were offering an apology to everyone. At the same time, he was struggling so sincerely that you didn't want to stop or interrupt him. You liked him and just wished that he could relax. Yet he made you feel guilty for being irritated with him because of how hard and unsuccessfully he was trying to put you at ease. Dan said,
I came here to ask you if you knew the name of the head guy at St. Michael's. It's the same guy for the church and for the school, isn't it?
That's right, Pastor Merrill said. It's Father Findlay.
I guess I don't know him, Dan said. I thought it was a Father O somebody.
No, it's not an O anybody, said Mr. Merrill. It's Father Findlay. The Reverend Mr. Merrill did not yet know why Dan wanted to know who the Catholic head guy was. Owen, of course, knew what Dan was up to.
You don't have to do anything for me, Dan,
Owen said. I can try to keep you out of jail, Dan said. I want you to get into college and to have a scholarship, but at the very least, I can try to keep you from getting charged with theft and vandalism, Dan said.
What did you do, Owen? The Reverend Mr. Merrill asked him.
Owen bowed his head. For a moment, I thought he was going to cry, but then he shrugged off this moment, too. He looked directly into the Reverend Lewis Merrill's eyes.
I want you to say a prayer for me, said Owen Meany.
A prayer? For you? The Reverend Mr. Merrill stuttered.
Just a little something, if it's not too much to ask, Owen said. It's your business, isn't it?
The Reverend Mr. Merrill considered this. Yes, he said cautiously. At morning meeting? He asked.
Today, in front of everybody, said Owen Meany.
Yes, all right, the Reverend Lewis Merrill said, but he looked as if he might panic. Dan took my arm and steered me toward the door of the vestry office. We'll leave you alone if you want to talk, Dan said to Mr. Merrill and Owen. Was there anything else you wanted? Mr. Merrill asked Dan.
No, just Father Findlay, his name, Dan said.
And was that all you wanted to see me about, the prayer? Mr. Merrill asked Owen, who appeared to consider the question very carefully, or else he was waiting for Dan and me to leave. We were outside the vestry office, in the dark corridor, where two rows of wooden pegs, for coats, extended for the entire length of two walls. Off in the darkness, several lost or left behind overcoats hung there, like old churchgoers who had loitered so long that they had fallen asleep, slumped against the walls. And there were a few pairs of galoshes in the corridor, but they were not directly beneath the abandoned overcoats, so that the churchgoers in the darkness appeared to have been separated from their feet. On the wooden peg nearest the door to the vestry office was the Reverend Mr. Merrill's double-breasted and oddly youthful navy pea jacket, and, on the peg next to it, his seaman's watch cap. Dan and I, passing these, heard Pastor Merrill say, "Owen, is it the dream? Have you had that dream again?"
"Yes,"
said Owen Meany, who began to cry. He started to sob, like a child. I had not heard him sound like that since the Thanksgiving vacation when he'd peed in his pants, when he'd peed on Hester. "Owen? Owen, listen to me," Mr. Merrill said. "Owen, it's just a dream. Do you hear me? It's just a dream."
"No,"
said Owen Meany. Then Dan and I were outside, in the February cold and gray. The old footprints in the rutted slush were frozen, fossils of the many souls who had traveled to and from Herd's Church. It was still early morning. Although Dan and I had seen the sun rise, the sun had been absorbed by the low, uniformly ice-gray sky. "What dream?" Dan Needham asked me.
"I don't know," I said.
Owen hadn't told me about the dream, not yet. He would tell me, and I would tell him what the Reverend Mr. Merrill had told him, that it was just a dream. I have learned that the consequences of our past actions are always interesting. I have learned to view the present with a forward-looking eye, but not then. At that moment, Dan and I were not imagining very much beyond Randy White's reaction to the headless, armless Mary Magdalene, whose steely embrace of the podium on the stage of the Great Hall would force the headmaster to address the school from a new and more naked position. Directly opposite the main academy building,
The headmaster was getting into his camel hair overcoat. His wife, Sam, was brushing the nap of that pretty coat for him and kissing her husband goodbye for the day. It would be a bad day for the headmaster. A
faded
day, Owen Meany might have called it, but I'm sure Randy White didn't have his eyes on the future that morning. He thought he was finished with Owen Meany. He didn't know that in the end, Owen Meany would defeat him. He didn't know about the vote of no confidence the faculty would give him, or the decision of the Board of Trustees to not renew his appointment as headmaster. He couldn't have imagined what a travesty Owen Meany's absence would make of the commencement exercises that year, how such a timid, rather plain, and much-ignored student, who was the replacement valedictorian of our class, would find the courage to offer as a valedictory only these words, "I am not the head of this class. The head of this class is Owen Meany. He is the voice of our class, and the only voice we want to listen to." Then that good, frightened boy would sit down to tumultuous pandemonium, our classmates raising their voices for the voice, bedsheets and more artful banners displaying his name in capital letters, of course, and the chanting that drowned out the headmaster's attempts to bring us to order. "Owen Meany! Owen Meany! Owen Meany!" cried the class of 62. But that February morning, when the headmaster was outfitting himself in his camel hair coat, he couldn't have known that Owen Meany would be his undoing. How frustrated and powerless Randy White would appear at our commencement, when he threatened to withhold our diplomas if we didn't stop our uproar. He must have known then that he had lost, because Dan Needham and Mr. Early and a solid one-third or one-half of the faculty stood up to applaud our riotous support of Owen, and we were joined by several informed members of the Board of Trustees as well, not to mention all those parents who had written angry letters to the headmaster regarding that illiberal business of confiscating our wallets. I wish Owen could have been there to see the headmaster then, but of course, Owen wasn't there. He wasn't graduating. And he was not at morning meeting on that February day just before spring vacation. But the surrogate he had left on stage was grotesquely capable of holding our attention. It was a packed house, so many of the faculty had turned out for the occasion. And Mary Magdalene was there to greet us, armless but reaching out to us, headless but eloquent, with the clean-cut stump of her neck, which was slashed at her Adam's apple, expressing so dramatically that she had much to say to us. We sat in a hush in the great hall, waiting for the headmaster. What a horrible man Randy White was. There is a tradition among good schools, when you throw out a senior, only months before he's scheduled to graduate, you make as little trouble for that student's college admission as you have to. Yes, you tell the colleges what they need to know, but you have already done your damage. You've fired the kid. You don't try to keep him out of college, too. But not Randy White. The headmaster would do his damnedest to put an end to Owen Meany's university life before it began. Owen was accepted at Harvard. He was accepted at Yale. And he was offered full scholarships by both. But in addition to what Owen's record said, that he was expelled from Gravesend Academy for printing fake draft cards and selling them to other students, in addition to that, the headmaster told Harvard and Yale and the University of New Hampshire much more. He said that Owen Meany was so virulently anti-religious that he had desecrated the statue of a saint at a Roman Catholic school, that he had launched a deeply anti-Catholic campaign on the Gravesend campus under the demand of not wanting a fish-only menu in the school dining hall on Fridays, and that there were charges against him for being anti-Semitic, too. As for the New Hampshire Honor Society, they withdrew their offer of an Honor Society scholarship. A student of Owen Meany's academic achievements was welcome to attend the University of New Hampshire, but the Honor Society, in the light of this distressing and distasteful information, could not favor him with a scholarship. If he attended the University of New Hampshire,
he would do so at his own expense. Harvard and Yale were more forgiving, but they were also more complicated. Yale wanted to interview him again. They quickly saw the anti-Semitic charges for what they were, a lie, but Owen was undoubtedly too frank about his feelings for, or rather against, the Catholic Church. Yale wanted to delay his acceptance for a year. In that time, their admissions director suggested Owen should find some meaningful employment, and his employer should write to Yale periodically and report on Owen's character and commitment. Dan Needham told Owen that this was reasonable, fair-minded, and not uncommon behavior on the part of a university as good as Yale. Owen didn't disagree with Dan. He simply refused to do it.
"It's like being on parole," he said.
Harvard was also fair-minded and reasonable, and slightly more demanding and creative than Yale. Harvard said they wanted to delay his acceptance, too, but they were more specific about the kind of meaningful employment they wanted him to take. They wanted him to work for the Catholic Church, in some capacity. He could volunteer his time for Catholic relief services. He could be a kind of social worker for one of the Catholic charities. Or he could even work for the very same parochial school whose statue of Mary Magdalene he had ruined. Father Findlay at St. Michael's turned out to be a nice man. Not only did he not press charges against Owen Meany, after talking to Dan Needham, Father Findlay agreed to help Owen's cause, regarding his college admission, in any way he could. Even some parochial students had spoken up for Owen. Buzzy Thurston, who hit that easy ground ball, the one that should have been the last out, the one that should have kept Owen Meany from ever coming to bat. Even Buzzy Thurston spoke up for Owen, saying that Owen had had a tough time. Owen had his reasons for being upset, Buzzy said. Headmaster White and Chief Ben Pike were all for throwing the book at Owen Meany for the theft and mutilation of Mary Magdalene, but St. Michael's School and Father Findlay were very forgiving. Dan said that Father Findlay knew the family and was most sympathetic when he realized who Owen's parents were. He'd had dealings with the Meanys, and although he wouldn't go into any detail regarding what those dealings had been, Father Findlay said he would do anything he could to help Owen. "I certainly won't lift a finger to hurt him," Father Findlay said. Dan Needham told Owen that Harvard had a good idea. "Lots of Catholics do lots of good things, Owen," Dan said. "Why not see what some of the good things are?" For a while, I thought Owen was going to accept the Harvard proposal.
"The Catholic deal,"
he called it. He even went to see Father Findlay. But it seemed to confuse him how genuinely concerned for Owen's welfare Father Findlay was. Maybe Owen liked Father Findlay. That might have confused him, too. In the end, he would turn
"the Catholic deal"
down.
"My parents would never understand it,"
he said.
"Besides, I want to go to the University of New Hampshire. I want to stick with you. I want to go where you go,"
he told me. "But they're not offering you a scholarship," I reminded him.
"Don't worry about that," he said.
He wouldn't tell me at first how he'd already got a scholarship there. He went to the U.S. Army recruiting offices in Gravesend. It was arranged in the family, as we used to say in New Hampshire. They already knew who he was. He was the best of his class at Gravesend Academy, even if he ended up just barely getting his diploma from Gravesend High School. He was admitted to the University of New Hampshire. They also knew that. They had read about it in the Gravesend newsletter. What's more, he was a kind of local hero. Even though he had been absent, he had disrupted the Academy's commencement exercises. As for making and selling the fake draft cards, the U.S. Army recruiters knew what that was about. That was about drinking. No disrespect for the draft had been intended. They certainly knew that. And what red-blooded American young man didn't indulge in a little vandalism from time to time? And that was how Owen Meany got his scholarship to the University of New Hampshire. He signed up for the Reserve Officers Training Corps, ROTC. We called it ROTC. Remember that? You went to college at the expense of the U.S. Army, and while you were in college, you took a few courses that the U.S. Army offered. Military history and small unit tactics, stuff like that. Not terribly taxing. The summer following your junior year, you would be required to take a little basic training, the standard 6-week course, and upon your graduation, you would receive your commission. You would graduate a second lieutenant in the United States Army, and you would owe your country 4 years of active duty plus 2 years in the Army Reserve.
What could possibly be the matter with that?
Owen Meany asked Dan and me. When he announced his plans to us, it was only 1962. A total of 11,300 U.S. military personnel were in Vietnam, but not a single one of them was in combat. Even so, Dan Needham was uncomfortable with Owen's decision. I liked the Harvard deal better, Owen, Dan said.
This way, I don't have to wait a year, he said. And I get to be with you. Isn't that great?
He asked me. Yeah, that's great, I said. I'm just a little surprised, that's all, I told him. I was more than a little surprised. That the U.S. Army had accepted him was astonishing to me. Isn't there a height requirement? Dan Needham whispered to me. I thought there was a weight requirement, too, I said.
If you're thinking about the height and weight requirements,
Owen said,
it's 5 feet, even, and 100 pounds.
Are you 5 feet tall, Owen? Dan asked him. Since when do you weigh 100 pounds? I said.
I've been eating a lot of bananas and ice cream, said Owen Meany. And when they measured me, I took a deep breath and stood on my toes.
Well, it was only proper to congratulate him. He was quite pleased with arranging his college scholarship in his own way. And at the time, it appeared that he had defeated Randy White completely. Back then, neither Dan nor I knew about his dream. I think we might have been a little worried about his involvement with the U.S. Army if we'd had that dream described to us. And that February morning, when the Reverend Lewis Merrill entered the Great Hall and stared with such horror at the decapitated and amputated Mary Magdalene, Dan Needham and I weren't thinking very far into the future. We were worried only that the Reverend Mr. Merrill might be too terrified to deliver his prayer, that the condition of Mary Magdalene might seize hold of his normally slight stutter and render him incomprehensible. He stood at the foot of the stage, staring up at her. For a long moment, he even forgot to remove his navy pea jacket and his seaman's watch cap. And since Congregationalists don't always wear the clerical collar, the Reverend Lewis Merrill looked less like our school minister than like a drunken sailor who had finally staggered up against the incentive for his own religious conversion. The Reverend Mr. Merrill was standing there thus stricken when the headmaster arrived in the Great Hall. If Randy White was surprised to see so many faculty faces at morning meeting, it did not alter his usual aggressive stride. He took the stairs up to the stage at his usual two-at-a-time pace, and the headmaster did not flinch or even appear the slightest surprised to see someone already standing at the podium. The Reverend Lewis Merrill often announced the opening hymn. Pastor Merrill often followed the opening hymn with his prayer. Then the headmaster would make his remarks. He also told us the page number for the closing hymn, and that would be that. It took the headmaster a few seconds to recognize Mr. Merrill, who was standing at the foot of the stage in his pea jacket and wearing his watch cap and gawking at the figure who beseeched us from the podium. Our headmaster was a man who was used to taking charge. He was used to making decisions, our Randy White. When he saw the monstrosity at the podium, he did the first and most headmasterly thing that came into his mind. He strode up to the saint and seized her around her modest robes. He grabbed her around her waist and attempted to lift her. I don't think he took any notice of the steel bands girdling her hips or the 4-inch bolts that penetrated her feet and were welded to their respective nuts under the stage. I suppose his back was still a trifle sore from his impressive effort with Dr. Dolder's Volkswagen, but the headmaster didn't pay any attention to his back, either. He simply seized Mary Magdalene around her middle. He gave a grunt, and nothing happened. Mary Magdalene and all that she represented was not as easy to throw around as a Volkswagen.
"I suppose you think this is funny," the headmaster said to the assembled school,
but nobody was laughing.
"Well, I'll tell you what this is," said Randy White. "This is a crime," he said. "This is vandalism. This is theft and desecration. This is willful abuse of personal, even sacred property."
One of the students yelled.
"What's the hymn?" the student yelled. "What did you say?"
Randy White said.
"Tell us the number of the hymn,"
someone shouted.
"What's the hymn?"
said a few more students in unison. I had not seen the Reverend Mr. Merrill climb, I suppose shakily, to the stage. When I noticed him, he was standing beside the martyred Mary Magdalene. "The hymn is on page 388, Pastor Merrill said clearly. The headmaster spoke sharply to him, but we couldn't hear what the headmaster said. There was too much creaking of benches and bumping of hymnals as we rose to sing. I don't know what influenced Mr. Merrill's choice of the hymn. If Owen had told me about his dream, I might have